Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
By the summer of 1985, no one in Southern California felt safe behind a locked door because the man the papers were calling the Night Stalker didn't seem to have any kind of MO. He hit wealthy neighborhoods and poor ones. He attacked women, men, children, and the elderly from all different backgrounds and races. He killed with guns, with knives, and even with a hammer. The only real pattern he had was marking his crime scenes with satanic symbols. But even that wasn't consistent. For more than a year, he was a ghost, and the people chasing him were starting to wonder if they would ever put a name to his face. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime Show page. And to help keep growing our community, be sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of murder, sexual assault, and graphic violence, so please listen with care. This is the second of our three-episode series on Richard Ramirez, one of the most notorious serial killers in American history. Today, we'll talk about the summer his attacks exploded into a full-blown reign of terror, the satanic calling cards he left behind, and the detectives who slowly closed in on him. Just 10 days after the St. Patrick's Day killings of 1985, the Valley intruder struck again. And this time, he left investigators staring at something they'd never seen before. On the night of March 27th, he made his way to a quiet ranch-style home in Whittier, a suburb southeast of Los Angeles. It belonged to 64-year-old Vincent Zazzara and his 44-year-old wife, Maxine. He ran a pizza restaurant, and she was a sharp, successful attorney. They had a lot to look forward to in life, but Richard Ramirez took it all away from them. To get inside, he flipped over a plastic pail in the yard, used it as a step stool, and climbed through an open window. He shot Vincent where he'd fallen asleep. Then he turned to Maxine. Richard bound her and demanded to know where the couple kept their valuables. At some point, he left the room, and in those few seconds, Maxine worked herself loose and reached under the bed for the shotgun she knew her husband kept there. She pointed it at him and pulled the trigger, but it wasn't loaded. What Richard did to her after was so savage, it would haunt the detectives who worked the scene for the rest of their careers. He shot her, stabbed her repeatedly, and mutilated her body, including gouging out her eyes. The Zazzaras had been dead for 2 days before their son arrived and discovered them. There was one more detail at the Zazzara scene that would come into play later. Along with everything else, the killer had carved a crude symbol into Maxine's body. At the time, it seemed like another piece of senseless savagery, easy to file alongside the rest of the horror. But in a matter of weeks, that same symbol would surface again and again, scrawled on walls and traced onto the bodies of his victims, until there was no mistaking what the man behind these attacks wanted the world to believe about him. As brutal as they were, the Zazzara murders were only a preview. What unsettled investigators wasn't just the brutality itself, it was what the brutality represented. Taking a victim's eyes wasn't the act of a burglar who'd panicked. It was deliberate, almost ceremonial. For detectives who are familiar with robberies gone wrong and crimes of passion, the Zazara scene was almost incomprehensible. There was no clear motive and no logic to the crime. It was just a level of cruelty that felt intimate, even though the killer and his victims were most likely strangers. And it forced a question no one wanted to say out loud. If a man was capable of this, and if he was escalating, how much worse would he get before someone stopped him? The Zazara murders raised a terrifying technical possibility too. The killer had used a .22 caliber handgun, the same kind of weapon used to murder Dale Okazaki and Veronica Yu just 10 days earlier. However, the crime lab couldn't say for sure if the bullets had come from the same gun. With a small caliber like a .22, the rounds can distort too much to match cleanly. But the casings were consistent. It was possible, maybe even likely, that one man had done all of it. Looking closer, the sign stretched back even further to almost a year earlier in the summer of 1984 when 79-year-old Jenny Vincow had been murdered in her Glassell Park apartment, stabbed in her bed by an intruder who'd climbed through a window. But putting the pieces together wasn't easy. In 1985, there wasn't a single database tying these cases together, and the attacks were scattered across multiple police departments, the city of Los Angeles, the county sheriff, Monterey Park, Whittier, and more. Almost no one had a bird's eye view of it, except a young detective named Gil Carrillo. He was the youngest homicide investigator in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Bureau, and he'd started to notice things others were missing. Earlier in 1985, a string of child abductions had moved through the same cluster of eastern suburbs, and the young survivors had given descriptions of the man who took them. To Carrillo, those descriptions matched the one Maria Hernandez had given after she was shot in Rosemead, a tall man with dark hair dressed in black. Carrillo wondered if a single predator was moving through Los Angeles, striking at random. It was a bold thing for a young detective to suggest. Carrillo hadn't been in homicide long, and what he was proposing went against everything more experienced investigators believed. Serial offenders were supposed to be consistent. They picked a type and stuck to it. This theory asked his colleagues to accept a killer with no rules at all, and a lot of them weren't willing to do that. Carrillo kept at it anyway. He pulled reports from other agencies, compared methods and descriptions and small physical details that never make the news. The more he put it together, the harder his idea was to ignore. He just needed someone with the authority and the experience to stand behind it. So he took it to someone whose judgment carried weight, Frank Salerno. Salerno was a veteran homicide detective and honestly, kind of a legend. A few years earlier, he'd helped crack the Hillside Strangler case, one of the most notorious serial murder investigations in California history. If anyone would take the idea of a roaming serial killer seriously, it was him. But at first, even Salerno was skeptical. What Carrillo described didn't fit the usual pattern. The victims were too different. There was no consistency with the murder weapon. It was almost unheard of for a single offender to be so indiscriminate. But the more Salerno looked, the more he came around. And then came a piece of physical evidence that helped tie it all together, a shoe print. At the Zazara home, investigators had lifted the impression of a man's sneaker, an 11.5 size Avia, which wasn't a common brand. Shortly after, Carrillo learned that a nearly identical print was left in wet cement near the site of one of the child abductions. For the first time, the investigation had something solid. Not just a hunch, but evidence that physically connected the scenes. The shoe print confirmed the most chilling part of Carrillo's theory, that the man attacking adults in their beds was also the one preying on children nearby. Carrillo and Salerno became partners, convinced they were chasing a single killer. Then, for a few weeks in April, the attacks simply stopped. No new scenes, no fresh horrors, just an uneasy quiet. Maybe he'd moved on, maybe he was in custody somewhere on an unrelated charge, but the two detectives didn't believe in that kind of luck. They used the lull to keep building because they understood that a man like this didn't stop. He paused, and when the silence broke, it broke hard.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. TNCs apply.
The moment a body is found, the clock starts ticking. 48 hours. That's how long detectives have before the trail begins to go cold. From A&E and Crime House, this is the official podcast from the famous true crime series, The First 48. Step inside the critical window, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs that crack a case wide open. I'm Carter Roy. Each week, I revisit a landmark homicide investigation with the depth you know and immersive long-form storytelling built for your ears. Real detectives, real cases, real stakes. This is The First 48. New episodes every Thursday. Listen to and follow The First 48 on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The spring and summer of 1985 became one of the most relentless crime sprees the country has ever seen. On May 14th, the killer broke into the Monterey Park home of 65-year-old William Doy and his wife Lily. He shot William in the head. But as he lay dying, William managed to reach for a telephone and dial for help, an act that almost certainly saved his wife's life. Lily survived, but unfortunately, William didn't. 2 weeks later, the violence took on a darker, stranger character. On the night of May 29th, the intruder attacked 83-year-old Mabel Bell and her disabled sister, Florence Lang, in their home in Monrovia. He beat them both with a hammer, and before he left, he drew satanic pentagrams at the scene, including one on Mabel's body. The sisters were found alive the next day, but Mabel never fully recovered, and she later died of her injuries. The very next day, the attacker struck again, sexually assaulting a woman named Carol Kyle in her home before leaving her alive. The pattern was becoming clear and unbearable. He didn't only want to kill, he wanted to terrorize, to defile, to leave a mark that went beyond the physical. The pentagrams and the forced declarations of love for Satan weren't random flourishes. They were the point. To the people of Los Angeles and increasingly to the press, it started to feel like the city was being hunted by something that believed it had a dark kind of permission, a man who walked into ordinary bedrooms and brought the devil in with him. And he didn't slow down. Through June and July, the attacks came at a sickening pace, sometimes more than one a week. In early July, 77-year-old Mary Louise Cannon was killed in her home in Arcadia. Days later, 16-year-old Whitney Bennett was attacked in Sierra Madre and, against all odds, survived. There was 61-year-old Joyce Nelson killed in her home, and another woman, Sophie Dickman, who survived a brutal assault. There was Max and Layla Knighting, an elderly married couple who were killed together. There was China Rong Covenant, shot dead while his wife Som Kid was assaulted and left alive. In August, Chris and Virginia Peterson were both shot in their home, and both lived. And then 35-year-old Elias Abawath was killed while his wife Sakina was assaulted and spared. His victims spanned the whole range of ordinary life, newlyweds and widows, the wealthy and the working poor, the old and the young. There was no logic to who he chose. The only thing they shared was an unlocked door or a window left open against the heat. By midsummer, the attacks were coming so fast that detectives could barely keep up with the paperwork, let alone get ahead of him. The map of his crime sprawled across Los Angeles County and beyond, leaping from one community to the next with no obvious route. Each new scene meant another set of grieving families, another round of headlines, and another layer of dread settling over a region that was starting to feel collectively haunted. The whole time, the man behind it was hiding in plain sight. For most of the spree, Richard Ramirez was living downtown in the heart of LA's Skid Row at the notorious Cecil Hotel. By day, the Night Stalker was just another drifter on Skid Row, buying cheap liquor and blending into a part of the city most people tried not to see. He was only a few miles from the very neighborhoods he was terrorizing, and no one around him had any idea. But out in those neighborhoods, the investigation was finally taking shape. Carrillo and Salerno were now at the center of a growing task force. Ballistics tied the .22 caliber to scene after scene. The Avia shoe print kept turning up, and survivors described the same man, tall and thin with dark curly hair, wide eyes, and rotting, gapped teeth. Not to mention how his breath and body odor were so foul that they were impossible to forget. From those accounts, sketch artists built composites and circulated them across the city. The problem was that a rough drawing of a thin, dark-haired man could match thousands of people in LA. The police would need more than that to put him away. By the middle of August, the press had given him the name that would stick. He'd been the Valley Intruder and, for a while, the Walk-In Killer. Now, as the attack spread and the fear deepened, reporters christened him the Night Stalker. The name captured exactly what made him so terrifying. In the summer of 1985, LA felt like a city under siege. Gun stores sold out, locksmiths couldn't keep up with the demand for deadbolts and window bars. People who'd always slept with their windows open in the heat now shut and locked them, sweltering through the night. The fear changed how people lived. Neighbors who'd never spoken to each other organized watch groups. Hardware stores ran out of motion sensor lights, and families crowded into single rooms so no one would be alone. As I mentioned in last episode, it didn't help that the country was already gripped by what would later be called the Satanic Panic, a wave of fear about devil worship that made a killer leaving pentagrams feel like the embodiment of every nightmare being whispered. It felt like the terror would never end. But in the middle of August, the Night Stalker did something nobody expected. He left Los Angeles. On the night of August 17th, 1985, the Night Stalker struck 400 miles north in San Francisco. His targets were 66-year-old Peter Pan and his wife Barbara, asleep in their home in the city's Lake Merced neighborhood. He shot Peter in the head, killing him. Then he beat and shot Barbara, but somehow she survived. Before he left, he drew a pentagram on the wall in lipstick and scrawled words invoking the devil. It was the same signature he'd been leaving across LA. The attack confirmed something investigators had feared. The Night Stalker was no longer contained. The Night Stalker could be anywhere in California now, and the panic that had gripped the South spread north overnight. San Francisco, which had watched the Los Angeles nightmare from a distance, suddenly understood it was no longer a spectator. But thankfully, Barbara Pan survived the assault. And when she recovered enough to speak with investigators, she was able to identify her attacker from the police sketches built up from earlier survivors. The killings in San Francisco and the killings in Los Angeles were clearly the work of the same man. But the San Francisco attack also produced one of the most controversial moments of the entire investigation. In the days afterward, the city's mayor, Dianne Feinstein, held a press conference and publicly described specific details investigators had been keeping close to the chest, including the type of gun and the brand of shoe linked to the killer. For the detectives, it was a disaster. Those details were among the few advantages they had, and the killer was watching. Sure enough, soon after the press conference, Richard got rid of the evidence that could tie him to the crimes, reportedly throwing his shoes off the Golden Gate Bridge and disposing of his gun. It became a lasting lesson in the delicate balance between informing the public and protecting an investigation. For the detectives who'd spent months painstakingly building the case piece by piece, watching that leverage vanish on the evening news was its own kind of agony. But even without that information in their pocket, they were still closing in, and the break they needed wouldn't come from careful forensics at all. It would come from a stolen car and a wide-awake teenager. After attacking the Pans, Richard headed back to LA, and a week later, on August 24th, 1985, he stole a bright orange Toyota and drove south, more than 50 miles down to Mission Viejo, a quiet community in Orange County. He was a long way from the dense, anonymous neighborhoods where he usually worked. And in a place like Mission Viejo, a stranger in a battered orange car stood out. Late that night, a 13-year-old boy named James Romero III noticed a man in dark clothes prowling near his family's home. Something about him felt wrong. James woke his father up, and the two of them watched the man hurry off and drive away in the orange Toyota. James had the presence of mind to write down part of the license plate, and his family called the police. It was the kind of detail that's easy to overlook and impossible to overstate. In a case defined for over a year by a killer who left almost nothing behind, a teenager's alertness became one of the most important pieces of the whole investigation. Meanwhile, that same night, the Night Stalker forced his way into the home of 30-year-old Bill Carnes, a computer engineer, and his fiancée, Inez Erickson. He beat her, sexually assaulted her, and forced her to say over and over that she loves Satan. Before he left, he told her to tell them the Night Stalker had been there. It was meant as another act of terror. Instead, it helped end his reign of fear, because both Bill Carnes and Inez Erickson survived. Inez was also able to give a description, and she'd seen the orange Toyota. This time, the pieces came together fast. Investigators matched the partial plate James Romero had reported to a car that had been reported stolen. Days later, the abandoned Toyota turned up in a parking lot, and it wasn't simply searched. It was treated as the most important piece of evidence in California, and it got them a single, clean fingerprint from the rearview mirror. The print went north to Sacramento to a tool that had only just come online, California's first computerized fingerprint database. For decades, matching a stray print had meant comparing it by hand against endless files, a process that could swallow weeks or months. Now, a machine could do that work in minutes. The technology was so new that there's almost no way Richard Ramirez knew about it. He'd spent more than a year exploiting the gaps between agencies and the limits of 1980s forensics, but those gaps didn't exist anymore. For more than a year, the Night Stalker had been a phantom, a method, a shoe size, a sketch, a feeling of dread hanging over all of California. He had no name and no face. But somewhere in a government computer, a fingerprint lifted from a stolen car was about to be matched to a record. And once they had his name, everything would change. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts. So make sure to comment below.
How is it even possible that all of these murders were happening and police didn't realize one person was behind them? It seems obvious in hindsight.
It does seem obvious now, but I want to be fair to the investigators because 1985 was a completely different world. There was no shared computer system flagging that a .22 used in Monterey Park matched a casing from Whittier. The crimes were spread across a dozen different agencies, and each one was looking at its own little slice. On top of that, this killer broke every rule profilers thought they understood. He had no consistent victim, no consistent weapon, no consistent neighborhood. That randomness wasn't just terrifying for the public. It actively worked against the people trying to connect the dots. So the real story here isn't how did they miss it. It's how one young detective named Gil Carrillo trusted a hunch that everyone around him dismissed, and how a veteran like Frank Salerno was willing to listen. That's the part I find remarkable. The breakthrough wasn't a computer. It was two people refusing to look away and two police departments willing to work together.
The satanic elements, the pentagrams, forcing victims to swear love for the devil. Was that real belief or was it just theater?
I think it was a bit of both. And we talked last episode about how Satanism functioned for him mostly as a justification and permission for his actions. But from what we saw in yesterday's crimes, Richard would pray to the devil to not get caught after doing these unspeakable acts. When he started to get away with more and more crimes, I think he started to fall into his beliefs even further. It seems like the more crimes he got away with, the more eccentric his devotions to the devil became. I think it was also performative. Most serial killers enjoy having a nickname and a reputation, and he fully leaned into his. But part of the theatrics was also a way of asserting dominance and control. Many of his victims who believed in God were forced to renounce him and praise Satan. This served as both personal satisfaction for him to see the fear and have control of his victims, and also a way to serve the devil.
Let's talk about the Feinstein press conference. How big a mistake was that, really?
From an investigative standpoint, it was a critical error. These were two of the only pieces of evidence that connected all of these random crimes. The fact that they were left at almost every crime scene meant he was not aware his crimes were being connected and how. The moment they were public, the killer knew exactly what to get rid of, and he did. We can't run the alternate timeline, and I can't tell you if it would have saved lives or not, but it's a textbook example of why investigators hold certain facts back and why the relationship between law enforcement and the public has to be handled with care. I'll also say, in fairness, that she was a mayor under enormous pressure trying to reassure a terrified city. I understand the instinct, but it was still the wrong call, and I think even regular civilians would know not to share those facts.
So many people in this episode survived. Barbara Pan, Inez Erickson, Lily Doy, Bill Carnes, the Petersons. That's striking given how violent he was.
It is, and I never want those survivors to be a footnote. Some of them lived through things most of us can't imagine, and then found the strength to sit down with detectives and describe the man who did it. Those descriptions are a huge part of why this case got solved. Barbara Pan identifying him from a sketch, each person giving the best description they could, and Inez Erickson seeing that orange car, that's not luck. That's courage under unthinkable circumstances. And it's a reminder that the people in these stories are not just victims. They're witnesses, fighters, survivors. Bill Carnes is still living with a bullet in his head decades later. We owe it to them to keep them front and center.
As a self-defense instructor, what's the takeaway from this stretch of the case?
Pretty much the same thing I said last time, and I'll keep saying it because it's one concrete lesson here. The entry point. Over and over was an unlocked door, open window, or even an unlocked car door. He wasn't a master cat burglar. He wasn't picking locks. He walked into homes people had left open, often in the summer heat. So lock up, even when it's hot, even when you feel safe in a quiet neighborhood, especially then. Beyond that, what this episode really teaches is the value of paying attention and the see something, say something rule. A 13-year-old boy noticed something that felt off and wrote down a license plate, and that single act helped bring down one of the most wanted men in America. You don't have to confront anyone, you just have to notice and report it. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. To enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime show page. Come back tomorrow for our final episode on one of America's most notorious serial killers, Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker. Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.